This is Culturetopia, your weekly roundup of the very best arts and culture stories from NPR. I am Netta Ulaby of NPR's Arts Desk.
And I'm Elizabeth Blair, also from the Arts Desk.
You can, as always, subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. This week,
author Sebastian Fox returns with a new book called A Week in December.
An opera singer must prepare for the challenging role of Ophelia in only 2 days.
And Danger Mouse and James Mercer of indie rock band The Shins team up for a new band, Broken Bells. But first, this year on NPR and NPR Music, we've been exploring 50 great voices, singers who made their mark in many styles of music and across the decades. Today, we're going to hear about Kulthum, a singer from Egypt. She's been dead for over 30 years, but Kulthum is still one of the Arab world's biggest stars. Netta, this was your profile, and it even comes complete with a little lesson in Arabic. Let's listen in.
I did not really understand Kulthum's mystique. I grew up in the U.S., so I asked my dad to explain. Ulubi is a Syrian name, and my dad, Fawaz, has this story's first vocabulary lesson. It's Imta Omri, the name of Kulthum's signature song. My dad says Kulthum was a soundtrack to his youth in the Middle East.
Her voice was everywhere. It was like she was ubiquitous.
What was it about her voice?
It's hard to describe. Their words penetrate into your ears, into your psyche, into your brain when you're listening to her saying things like Inta Umri, which means you are my life, you are my world.
Inta Umri, Inta Umri.
There was such passion, such total devotion.
She has a very powerful voice with a lot of nasal resonance, and this is all good.
Ethnomusicologist Virginia Danielson is a renowned expert on Kulthum, but at first she did not understand what cued those cheers of approval during Kulthum's songs. She learned the audience responded whenever the singer closed the gap between poetry and emotion. More vocabulary here. When Kulthum sings the words, "I'm afraid your heart belongs to somebody else," she completely nails the way that anguish should sound.
And the way she treats the word "somebody else," which is insane, is just heart-rending. And you can hear the feeling of the poem come through in the way that she sings it.
It's often occurred to me that you never see Arabs smiling when you watch TV in the U.S. But in videos of Kulthum in concert, her entire audience is wreathed in grins. Literally, people cannot contain their pleasure. Kulthum's legendary concerts were broadcast live from Cairo. On the first Thursday of each month, from the 1930s to the early 1970s, the Arab world's buzz and bustle stopped. From Medina to Marrakesh, from Jeddah to Jerusalem, shops closed, families gathered to listen for 4, 5, even 6 hours of rapture. Kulthum was drenched in religious music as a child. Her father was a village cleric. They sang together at weddings and funerals. When Kulthum went to Cairo as a young woman, people laughed at her cheap clothes and country manners. They whispered she did not know how to use a knife or fork. But Kulthum smartly crafted an image that played on the romance of being from the land. She began studying classical poetry and music, and she copied the wealthy Muslim women who were becoming her fans. Kulthum was never beautiful, but she ripened into a sophisticated star.
She was the original diva for us.
Suher Hamad is a Palestinian-American poet and a disciple of Umm Kulthum's ability to juice lines and embellish language. She says Umm Kulthum's songs were usually not really religious, but they all reflected a childhood spent praising God.
There's something about the fact that even when she's not saying Allah, she has said it so many times in her life that everything is inflected with the notion of Allah, of the Most High.
Allah, 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 ya habibi, ala hubbak, Allah, Allah.
It's like Sam Cooke's music for me, something about church and fellowship and Jum'ah, Friday prayer.
It's fair to liken Umm Kulthum's music to the blues in the way she blended together Quranic recitation, classical love poems, and folk songs. Here's your last vocabulary word. It's tarab, a unique quality of Arab music explained by ethnomusicologist Virginia Danielson.
It translates best to the word enchantment, but what it refers to is the experience of really being carried away by music. People would tell preposterous stories about getting up and leaving the house and not knowing where they were going, and just all kinds of experience of completely forgetting your troubles, completely being outside yourself, having been transported by the experience.
At a moment when the Arab world was buffeted by modernity, the aftershocks of 19th century colonialism, corrupt leaders, and the new Israeli state, Umm Kulthum's voice was a lodestar. Part of tarab is the idea that listeners are as crucial as musicians. And Umm Kulthum and her audience together created something sweet and whole. Neda Ulibi, NPR News. Elizabeth, you created 50 Great Voices.
Well, you're the... It's giving me way too much credit, but sure, I'll take it.
So how's the series been coming together, and what do we have to look forward to?
The series is going very well. I think listeners are appreciative. I know NPR staff is enjoying it, so...
Any responses that have been particularly notable on any of the pieces?
We did have one commenter who said, why don't you just call this 50 Great Voices You Hicks Have Never Heard Of? And that was first I was like, gosh, she really thinks, you know, we're trying to, this is NPR, eat your broccoli, you should know these singers. But really now as it's going along, people who are from these regions are wildly appreciative. Thank you, NPR, for recognizing this hero who I've known about all my life, but my American friends have never heard of. So, it's going great.
Cool. Now, if we're going to do a series called 50 Great International Spy Characters, number one would definitely be James Bond.
Definitely.
Author Sebastian Fox is probably best known for his book Devil May Care, which was kind of a sequel to Ian Fleming's famous series. And he's got a new book out called A Week in December. The novel is a 7-day tour of modern London, some of it on the Underground, the famous Circle Line train. In rather Dickensian fashion, Fox creates an enormous variety of characters and issues. But while Dickens explored class conflict, wealth, poverty, and true love, Fox is about terrorism, greed, the internet, and true love. NPR's Linda Wertheimer spoke with Fox and asked him how he came up with the main character's name, John Veals.
I got his name actually from a real estate agent. I went past in a bus in Oxford, whose name was Douglas Veal. And I liked the name Veal because it's a bit like venal. And of course also veal is a kind of bloodless meat. And these things to me suggested the character of John Veals, who is a hedge fund manager. And he is an extremely cold, bloodless, rapacious, greedy son of a gun. Can I say gun on NPR?
Of course you can. Here's the other thing about a novel that is huge in scope, as the reviewers said about yours. You made the Circle Line, the subway line, which sort of encircles central London. You made that the image to sort of contain your characters, to give us an extraordinary view of London as it is now, the sort of the polyglot city and all. But the idea, I suppose, is that the book has to come full circle. Now, I should have thought that by the time you're about 75% of the way through the book, you would be thinking, oh, my God, how am I going to do it?
You're right that the book is really about London and it's about the different parts. But I did actually change the ending of A Week in December as I went along when I realised that the impulse of the book is so satirical that although it's a dark and angry book and it has dark and serious things to say about the way we live, I wanted there to be sunlight at the end. When you climb out of the Circle Line train, you emerge into the sun.
You've also got a good and evil thing going with books. You have a character who has nothing but contempt for fiction, who reviews without reading, who hates writers. And then you have this very sweet man who is the lawyer for the driver of the Circle Line train. She is the driver of the Circle Line train. He is a reading man, and he wants to talk to her about books. On page 196, he says, "You like reading. Could you just read for a bit?"
Yeah. "And what about reading?" said Gabriel as they moved off again. "You like reading, don't you?" "Yeah, I do." "Why?" "Dunno. Suppose it's an escape from the real world." "But surely it's just the opposite," said Gabriel. "Books explain the real world. They bring you close to it in a way that you could never imagine in the course of the day. People never explain to you exactly what they think and feel and how their thoughts and feelings work, do they? They don't have time or the right words. But that's what books do. It's as though your daily life is a film in the cinema. It can be fun looking at those pictures. But if you want to know what lies behind the flat screen, you have to read a book. That explains it all."
You can hear the full interview at npr.org/culturetopia.
We're going to go now to three-minute fiction. The concept behind it is simple. NPR asks listeners to send in original short stories that can be read in 3 minutes or less. For the most recent round, contestants were supposed to write a story inspired by a photograph by Rob Hill. That image depicts a lonely newspaper seen through a plate glass window. More than 3,000 stories poured in from all over the country. Stories about cafes and trains from London to Maine. But with help from the Iowa Writers Workshop and the judge for this round, writer and all things considered book critic Alan Shoes, the winner was finally chosen. "Please Read" by Rhonda Strickland from Raleigh, North Carolina. NPR's Guy Raz spoke with the winning author and Shoes, who reads the short story here.
"In Tucson, we found the train-hopping kids and went with them to New York City. I was 15 and had never been out of Arizona. That summer, I'd learned to eat from dumpsters, carry a knife in my pocket, and sleep with my backpack chained to my waist. My girlfriend Sarah was scared to try, but when she saw I'd go without her, she came. New Mexico and Texas floated past, framed in the open rail car door. We slept under a Baton Rouge bridge, partied in New Orleans, changed trains in Atlanta. Sarah was liking this now. At Penn Station, we stepped outside, and the cold stung our skin. We stood there and blinked. The other kids headed round back of a coffee shop to dumpster dive. Sarah called to me. I shook my head, and she went. I knew she'd bring back something, a stale donut, a still warm half cup of coffee. In the shop window, I studied my reflection. Wild red hair stuck out from knots Sarah couldn't untangle with her broken comb. My eyes seemed too large and staring. My beard still looked strange. I thought of Phoenix. I'd left home over a month ago, telling no one. I hugged myself, shivering. We'd have to find coats, sweaters. I stopped seeing myself and looked through the glass at a warm table with a spread-open newspaper carelessly left behind. The pages fluttered each time a customer opened the door and went in. Sarah came up beside me, handed over a half-eaten apple. She said, 'No coffee.' Her hands were blue. She followed my gaze. 'We'll get newspapers tonight.' She meant for sleeping. Old papers were everywhere, littering the ground under bridges, inside doorways, beside creeks and riverbeds. We stuffed our clothes and covered ourselves when it rained. She said, 'Come on, Ben.' But I couldn't stop looking at the newspaper, how people walked past, ruffling the pages, not noticing. The paper danced in the draft they created and inched across the table, moving close to the edge. Sarah tugged my arm, and I looked anxiously at the Tucson kids rounding a corner, searching for food. I didn't know how to explain to Sarah. I wanted this paper. I wasn't thinking of Phoenix anymore, of my home and my parents. I wanted to fold this newspaper shut with a crease, protect it from the gray, sooty day, keep it from falling to the floor where it would soon get covered in black shoe prints. But I couldn't get myself to go in, take it from the table. In its perfect frame of polished wood and gleaming glass, lit by lamps and the glowing smiles of people sipping coffee from steaming china cups, I knew the paper wasn't mine."
you know, if you listen to the whole interview, which you can on NPR.org, there's a moment where Guy is talking to Rhonda Strickland and to Alan Chews, and it turns out that she had been a student of his.
Alan Chews?
Mm-hmm. And Guy says, so Alan, do you remember her at all? And Alan Chews says, well, I remember her name. I don't remember her writing. It's actually kind of a really awful moment. But how satisfying that she got him to read her story.
Yeah, and it sounds like a great story.
It is a great story. Mm. Now, a backstory at the Metropolitan Opera, where the singer who was supposed to be playing Ophelia dropped out two nights before the opening night of the opera Hamlet. The new Ophelia, a German soprano named Marlies Petersen, only had 2 days in New York to cram for the role. NPR's Robert Smith followed her as she frantically rehearsed.
Petersen was in Vienna, starring in a production of Medea, when she got the call from the Metropolitan Opera.
In first moment, I thought I can't make it.
Her last performance in Vienna was Friday night. Even if she could rearrange her schedule, it would mean 2 days in New York to prepare for a major role.
I thought it's absolutely crazy to do that.
The rest of the cast of the French opera Hamlet had been rehearsing since mid-February, but soprano Nathalie Dessay hurt her back, and New York needed Petersen.
And then I thought, okay, come, you will do it. Be courageous, and it's saving the Metropolitan Opera. Come on, that's wonderful.
Don't enter really before the queen really calls you.
But Petersen might not have pictured this. 30 hours before curtain, and she is mobbed. Costumers, directors, vocal coaches all need just a few minutes to fix this or suggest that. Normally, opera singers rest for the 2 days before an opera, you know, like a major league pitcher. But yesterday, they brought in the whole orchestra just for Petersen. Ophalie, as the French say it, is going mad in this scene. She tosses her flowers left and right, and spoiler alert, she kills herself on stage. Perhaps it's the lack of sleep or growing panic, but Petersen has this crazy part down pat. But when she goes to cut her wrists, she misses the packet of stage blood strapped to her arm.
It's not easy because I can't look at them. You know, and this is why you sometimes don't get the right spot, and of course it can happen.
Sitting out in the empty opera hall is Petersen's vocal coach for the performance, Pierre Vallée. He flew out to Vienna to prep Petersen on the music as she was packing to come to New York. Vallée says that she's cramming so much into her brain that it does make it exciting to watch.
There's an intensity to her acting and to her singing that is very, very good.
Yeah. You say intensity, I say desperation.
Maybe both. I mean, you can see, you read her very, very well on stage. She's very, very, very concentrated.
Because she has to be. Giant 25-foot castle walls rotate in and out of this production, and you wouldn't want one of those smacking you. Petersen gets briefed on how to walk in her bell-shaped white gown. Little steps, don't swing your butt. Every time Petersen comes out for a scene, she's trying on a different wig. Golden blonde, ash blonde, brunette. They are costuming her on the fly. The co-director slumps in his chair. Patrice Corrier says it's nerve-wracking. His great fear isn't all these small mistakes. It's the biggie.
It's the memory. It's to suddenly when you have a blank, I don't know if you say that in English, a blank, and you say, what's coming next? You know, and the time, even if it lasts for 2 seconds, it seems like an eternity, and you panic. Voilà, and I hope she'll be safe from that experience.
He looks around for a piece of wood to knock on. Because Petersen didn't arrive until after the final dress rehearsal, the director won't get to see the full production until the audience does tonight. The only one who doesn't seem nervous is the star herself. When Marlies Petersen makes a mistake, she laughs and wraps her knuckles against her skull. She realizes, though, that this is a huge gamble. The more she crams, the harder she works in rehearsal, the more tired her voice gets.
Your voice is telling you, okay, stop now. And when you don't, it gets hurt. And this is, it's walking on the edge. I wasn't sure if this is a good idea. But of course, now I have to shut up.
At the risk of ruining the whole production by making her answer just one more question, I do have to ask. After a week of almost nonstop singing, what will she do after tonight's opening?
I think fall asleep for another 3 days.
Robert Smith, NPR News, New York.
A footnote, she got rave reviews. The New York Times called her a lovely woman with a bright, alluring, and agile voice who seemed immersed in a role that, to judge from her beautiful and emotionally vulnerable singing, she clearly relishes.
What a story of serious performance anxiety. And now we're going to completely switch gears. We're going to hear a conversation with Tom Burrell, longtime advertising executive. He wrote the book Brainwashed, Challenging the Myth of Black Inferiority. He argues that the most successful propaganda campaign is for black inferiority, from posters that advertised slaves for sale to The New Yorker's Radical Obama's cover. Recently, Tom Burrell spoke with NPR's Neil Conan.
We spend an inordinate amount of money, of the money that we make, on goods and services, primarily goods that we really don't have to have. Mm-hmm. And goods that are usually depreciated from the time that we get it. They start depreciating. But you ask the question, well, why is it that we spend everything that we have on things that aren't going to appreciate for us? And the answer lies in the fact that when we came to this country, we were stripped of everything. We were stripped of our name, of our origin, of our language, of our religion. We lost contact with our families. We had nothing. And we lost our status as human beings because we came here and were deemed to be property, less than human. We were put on the auction block and we were sold like cattle, okay? So in our attempt in a materialistic, capitalistic society to gain somebodiness, what do? In a materialistic society, we try to do it through getting stuff and owning stuff. And it's not a matter of buying things that we can't show off. It's all about things that we can show off that basically are saying, hey, look at me, world. Mm-hmm. I am somebody.
Some people might point out that emancipation happened in 1865. The great civil rights legislation of 1965 ended the era of Jim Crow, at least legally. Things have changed a lot. Yet you say the stain of that experience in slavery continues many generations later.
What we have to understand is that we aren't talking about ancient history. You know, we have slave narratives that were written in 1933, people who lived in slavery. So this whole idea that we're talking about ancient history, we're talking about a few generations ago. And these traditions, this inferiority that was drummed into us through the media, through propaganda, has passed down from generation to generation just like a favorite family recipe. After all of the efforts that have been made, we are still, as a people, at the top of just about every bad list.
In terms of.
And at the bottom of just education, income, incarceration, out of wedlock, childbirth, teen pregnancies, HIV, childhood obesity, infant mortality. I mean, just go through the list. And so you say, well, why is that? Well, it's because of the fact that we bought into the fact of the myth of black inferiority, and everybody else bought into that as well as the myth of white superiority.
You can hear the full interview at npr.org/culturetopia.
Here's a not-so-theoretical question. What happens when you blend the sounds of the Shins frontman, James Mercer, and producer Danger Mouse, a.k.a. Brian Burton, and one half of Gnarls Barkley? They all met at a Danish music festival 6 years ago and worked on last year's Dark Night of the Soul with Sparkle Horse. The two are now collaborating under the name Broken Bells. The band just released their self-titled album and had a rousing show at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas last week. Melissa Block spoke to Burton and Mercer about their musical collaboration and asked them to describe their deeply layered sound.
Very 80s. I was reading this book about, I think it was like 500 best singles ever or whatever, and it was mostly stuff from the late 70s all through the 80s, and the guy mentioned that every cool single had hand claps.
there are tons of layers on these songs, but you've made a point of saying that that this is not sampled, that that all the recording was done live in the studio.
Yeah.
Right, some of it sounds sampled because of how we treated it, but yeah, it's all performed there.
And that's important to you?
It's more fun.
Yeah, and I think the control that you have when you do that, if you decide you want to go left at this one moment, you don't have to interrupt. You can change the chord. You can do whatever you want on it. I think for us, this was definitely more about the songwriting and making cool songs that, you know, could just be played on a guitar or a piano or something. And then all the other stuff was just really for fun and sonically that had a lot of our influences in it.
Let's listen to one of the songs. This is Sailing to Nowhere.
To nowhere, sail nowhere, loving.
Brian, what are we hearing here?
Oh, gosh.
See, that part sounds like a sample, yeah.
This is a Wurlitzer with an acoustic guitar, and then it changes over to this really psychedelic kind of drums and Hammond organ.
Yeah.
I kind of meant for it to sound like it was this inserted piece from somewhere else, maybe.
There are a bunch of times on the album where James's vocals are sort of folded way back in this cushion of layered sound. And I'm wondering if at a point for you, Brian, maybe the lyrics became less important as words and as meaning, and really more as another instrument or another kind of texture that you're folding in.
Maybe. I think James's voice is definitely the lead instrument on this album. It's a good thing, I think. And I think it's important for when you're listening to music that when you're hearing it, you don't really picture the people making it. Instead, you picture something else visually, whether it's outer space or whether it's an island full of people or you traveling along with a girl somewhere or a guy somewhere or something. Whatever it is that comes to your mind based on what the music is doing, that's much more important to me as opposed to hearing
literal
something
meaning.
Yeah, or somebody is sitting there with a guitar singing to you. It's important that you're able to take this album and let it be part of your life, whether it's in the background or whether you really want to put on headphones and listen to every little part of it.
You can hear the full interview and listen to Broken Bell's set at South by Southwest, not to mention tons of other great concerts from the music festival at nprmusic.org. And that's it for this week.
You can find links to all the stories we've heard today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Elizabeth Blair.
And I am Netta Ulavi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.